This is why we love racing in all its forms.
And it's Lachlan Varaat's Pride's Easy Feed Victoria Cup.
Brodsky beat clear. All out but wins the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Pavement. What a ride. What a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Indeed we are. I'm Dan Malecki, and it's great every Saturday morning to be joined by Simone Fisher and Matt Stewart. Never really thought I was a 6 a.m. sort of a breakfast type of radio person, but you know what, guys? I really look forward to this. It's probably in my top five things that I look forward to every week. So it's great to join up with you two again. Good morning.
What are the other top four?
I don't know. It's just
what's,
you know,
better than this?
Family.
Give us the four things that are better than this.
Well, I didn't say, I said in the top five. I didn't say you were number five. Once okay. again, I'm going to get you those buds for your ears, you know, so you can.
Dan had a birthday during the week, Simone.
He did. Happy birthday, Dan. And good morning to you,
Thank
Dan,
you.
And also Matt. Good to be back. The trio's back again
Matt.
Every Saturday morning.
Yes,
you're caught up to Matt now.
Yeah. He'll never get past me, sadly. And no. Lauren's here as well, the work experience girl who just won't go away. She's here. And it's good that Lauren's here because I want to get her perspective on Rachel Blackmore and what that means for her generation as well. And Dan, I know you got a replay. We were talking about this last week, and who'd have thought that on top of Jamie Carr in the Doncaster, later that day, 30,000 Ks away, Rachel Blackmore will be the first female to ride the winner of the Aintree Grand National. And Lauren, the race has been around since 1837.
First female rider. So, yeah.
What was your reaction to that?
Oh, it's just incredible. Like, you know, there's so many women now just doing some amazing things in, you know, traditionally male-dominated sports. And, yeah, just a great other one to add to the list.
Yeah, and Simone, you're a slightly different generation to Lauren. And Lauren's doing her thing as well with bit of AFLW type activity, but your generation of women who would never have imagined, I would imagine, Simone, that a female jockey could win at Aintree, because it's been a male stronghold for 150 years, hasn't it? What was your reaction to Rachel Blackmore?
Sure. Oh, I just thought how wonderful, and just that suddenly the memes came up with National Velvet, and I remember watching that movie as a kid, and I didn't understand, and I the gravity of it at the time, and but you do now, and you do reflect, and you think, goodness, what an achievement for this young woman. But I think just breaking that mould, it's like when Michelle Payne won the Melbourne Cup, isn't it? It's just like breaking that tradition, and it has to happen at some point in time, and it happened this year. And she just seems like a wonderful ambassador for the sport too, Rachel. Just a lovely person and obviously a tremendous horsewoman. So it was a great day all round. And Jamie Carr, well, she's just an absolutely amazing person as well, isn't she?
Well, you mentioned National Velvet, and really, when you think about it, there wasn't a movie on the Melbourne Cup made 60 or 70 years ago about a female that was going to win the Melbourne Cup, but there was on the Grand National, and Velvet Brown. So that story has probably stimulated and inspired a lot of women to try to ride, first of all, against the men in the UK, and then over the jumps, and it all came to fruition in such a special way. And this is the way it happened. Last Saturday night in the wee hours, Sunday morning, to win the Aintree Grand National. I would think the most famous horse race in the world.
It's Manella times from Balco de Flo, Burrow Saint, any second now, the hoops with a white cap, staying on then Discorama, here's the final fence in the Randox Grand National, and over in front, and over two, three lengths clear, Manella times from Balco de Flo, any second now, continues to stay on, Burrow Saint wandering out into the centre of the track, they head towards the elbow, with over a furlong to cover in the National, but it's Rachel Blackmore and Manella times who are out four lengths clear of Balco de Flo, and any second now, Burrow Saint back in fourth is running on empty. 150 yards to go in the National. Manella times for J.P. McManus, Henry de Bromhead, and more significantly, Rachel Blackmore. History in the National. Manella times wins from Balco de Flo. Any second now is third, Burrow Saint four.
The only regret is that it was a bit like Dennis Pagan and Jai McNeil, Melbourne Cup and Derby, that it was achieved in front of no crowd, which was a terrible shame for Rachel. But as you say, Simone, her speech afterward was just magic, and the inspiration of people like Jamie Carr and Rachel Blackmore, and even down to the level of young Darcy, who seems to be getting into the swing of a similar sort of career, courtesy of a little video you sent us during the week.
That's right. But I just on the Grand National, the thing I love about it too is the pride that the British take in their horses and presenting them with their manes plaited. You know, in Australia, we don't sort of bother with that. The horses are turned out beautifully. But to go to that extra effort that you would do for a show ring or a dressage competition and in those high level sports. And I think it just, they look so beautiful with their manes plaited going over those jumps as well. But getting back to, yes, the pony trots, the dream is alive and well, and we headed out during the week to Tracy and Steve Loftus's place out near Ballarat, and she was very, very kind to let Darcy drive their little miniature pony, Miles, who's 21 and he's done lots and lots of miles, I think, but a very safe little pony for her to drive, and her son Daniel helped out as well. So she's already designed her silks.
Hey, there is an app, isn't there? Because my 15-year-old was sitting on the couch on his phone the other day. You know, you never really know what they're doing.
What they're doing.
And he said, look, Dad, I designed my own silks. I thought, gee, you're a weirdo. But Darcy was doing exactly the same thing at almost the same time across town in Lara on her phone.
Yeah, on the iPad that right. She is only allowed to have at, you know, certain times, and it's the Achilles heel. So as soon as she doesn't do what she's been asked, the iPad is taken off her. But yeah, she sat there at a well-known site, Highlands, I think, that a lot of people get their silks and outfits through. So she sat there, and there's so many different combinations. She's been sitting there for ages, just designing different ones and thinking, should she change the sleeve? Should she have her name on the cuff and all of that? But we've just got to do a training day and like an induction, I guess you could call it, and we'll just go from there. So it's still a little bit of a work in progress, but she thinks this is a lot of fun. I know where the fun will be, me getting this pony ready to go to.
Yes, you'll be part of the fun.
And yeah, driving around the countryside, but things you know, you do for your children.
You know how there's a staff shortage of Dan in skilled riders and all that? I'm going to ask you guys if there's a similar... Yeah. We have discussed this, actually, and we do know it crosses the codes, but I'm doing my bit to flood the racing industry with staff and... you know, Maxie's been going up to Gerald Egan's and riding the horses and rounding up animals and all this sort of stuff. So he's going well. And I took Ollie down to Doug Arnold's partner Courtney's place down at Turidon during the week. And Ollie wanted to get his skills upgraded. And she presented him with a 17.3 hand X racehorse. So I drop him off and I'm thinking, he's a bit of a faller in life, you know. So I wonder what'll happen. So I went to this cafe in Turidon to do some work, came back. Hour and a quarter later, and I could see he had mud over his shoulders, and I thought, that can only be a fall. So I asked him what happened, and Ollie said, oh, Dad, you wouldn't believe my display of horsemanship to almost stay on. The horse didn't respond well to a kick in the ribs, balked at a puddle, leapt 8 foot in the air, according to Ollie, and then Ollie miraculously stayed on and then ended up on his bum on the ground. So they say you got to have a fall before you can move on, and apparently you got back on pretty quick. So, you know, that Stuart courage comes to the fore again.
Could they have not found a smaller horse for him to start on, like something around 15.3 hands or 16 hands?
Well, Ollie's the equivalent of 18 hands himself, so they think right. They needed an equivalent horse. Daniel, what's been happening in your world this week?
Oh, look, it's been a good week. We've gone through our Indian summer type of weather, haven't we? We had a wonderful week leading around Easter. It's a bit chillier now for those people that like rugging up. I must admit, I still haven't quite adapted. I'm still into the shorts and the T-shirts. It hasn't quite got cold enough for me. Racing's been great. I really enjoyed last weekend. We've got a terrific race day today at Caulfield. We'll be out there a little bit later on, Matt. But in Sydney, of course, it's a $4 million race. It's the Queen Elizabeth. And it's probably brought together the race of the carnival, I would think. It's maybe the sprint race last week with Nature Strip, who was absolutely fantastic. But today's race, great matchup again. Race has got a terrific history. I plucked out a replay. Any guesses which one it might have been? I could have picked out plenty of them, but I just couldn't find them. So I've plucked out this one.
You could have picked out a few Winxes, but you wouldn't be that obvious. No. You're not an obvious sort of guy, so... It won't be Winx.
Yeah. No, it's not.
Okay. Simone, are you going to throw a...
Well, it's silly asking me because I don't know who is on the honour roll of the Queen Elizabeth Stakes, but I can read off the piece of paper that Dan sent us with who he's going to
yeah,
have.
Yeah, okay,
Dan,
why don't you do that instead? That'd be why don't you actually do that?
How about we take a listen to It's a Done Deal.
It's Carlton House in front. It's a done deal, three away. Another three lengths then to Silent Achiever. And then came Sacred Falls. Carlton House is still in front. It's a done deal. It's closing in with every stride. And then Sacred Falls. But on the outside, It's a Done Deal has run to the front. Sacred Falls is coming after him. He's coming fast, but It's a Done Deal is hanging on grimly. He peaks when it counts. It's a Done Deal beat Sacred Falls and Carlton House. Then Silent Achiever followed in behind them by...
He's a seriously good horse, It's a Done Deal. Yeah. I reckon underrated. Like those horses he beat, Sacred Falls is now a... Wasn't he a dual Doncaster winner, now a top sire, yeah, and Silent Achiever?
That's right.
Carlton House.
As a three-year-old, four-year-old, I think any argument you have, It's a Done Deal has to feature within the best of that age bracket. Certainly as a three-year-old, he dominated. He was a Kiwi. He wasn't big. There was a bit of courage under fire about him. You know, I might be drawing a loose bow in a sense, but from a harness perspective, courage under fire was good as it gets as a three-year-old. And I think It's a Done Deal certainly was from the New Zealand side. And the way he dominated, the particularly his three-year-old year, and he beat Atlantic Jewel, didn't he? He was the only horse to do that, and he was something else. And also successful at stud now as well.
You know who he was? The dead replica of probably 25 years after the original, Bozam. Same size, same series, sequence of races, same daisy cutting action, same wet track ability. Exact, I reckon almost the dead replica for Bozam. Is that a good one?
Remember Bozam? Bozam, I was in Canberra and they had the Queen Elizabeth Stakes. They would run a Queen Elizabeth Stakes at Canberra and there was a match race between Bone Crusher and Bozam.
Was it the Queen there, and, or was it to commemorate an anniversary of...
No, I'm pretty sure... Yeah, I think she was there, yeah. Yeah, and Bozam just nutted Bone Crusher. It was a wonderful race. Bozam started about a 6-4 favourite in a Caulfield Cup. Mm. And that was my first ever Caulfield Cup that I called. And Lord Ring was a brilliant ride from Brent Thompson from the outside gate, led all the way and won by an absolute pimple from Bozam.
Absolutely. Hey, Simone, we'll get to mentioning who our guests are shortly. And there was a massive yearling sale a week or so ago. I'm going to talk to one of the big players who's one of our good mates here on the program. But just before we do, Simon told Helen, ill-fated now.
Yeah, passed away last Friday night or Friday from a twisted bowel, which is one of those things that shocks everyone. It's not what you expect to hear all of a sudden when the greyhound was retired to stud, but then he sort of was making a comeback and he died from a twisted bowel, and his brother, who told Stevie, suffered the same fate. So you would perhaps think that it is a genetic thing, but I don't want to be, you know, touting that at all, but just so unfortunate. It really, you know, he had a cult following and so sad for Connections. I did send David Burnett a text during the week just to, you know, say how sad it was. And he that was his response. Just terribly, terribly sad. So that, and it's also been 12 months since Martin Power. We lost him as well. So two very, very significant animals for their respective racing codes. And can't believe Martin Power's been 12 months already.
The last time I saw Martin Power, he was standing in a corner of alleyway inside Bell's Hotel.
Bell's Hotel, yeah.
He bobbed up anywhere, Martin Power, didn't he?
Yeah.
Hey, Simone, why are we focusing on the premier greyhound racing track in Adelaide this morning?
So Matt Corby, the CEO of South Australian Racing, will be joining us a little bit later on to tell us about this big redevelopment of the track at Angle Park there, which is their metropolitan track. And there's some big developments going on there. The track will be closed for 4 months and they're rebuilding, and all racing will be transferred to Murray Bridge, Angola, for the 4 months. So really interested to hear the story behind why they are redeveloping the track. And so Matt will be joining us a little bit later on.
Interesting to know, you know how we've discussed before on the program of plans to put lures in different positions to greater benefit the greyhounds and the curvature of the tracks to eliminate an injury and so on. It'll be interesting to see if the redevelopment of Angle Park has any of these little modern advancements as part of the redevelopment or whether it doesn't. It doesn't matter either way, but it'll be interesting to see what Angle Park 2 looks like compared to Angle Park 1.
Oh, no doubt there'll be the latest in technology. They'll be building on every other track, the Meadows, Sandown, everywhere else across the country. They'll be building on every little bit of information that they've got. And, you know, this should be, you would say, the best track in Australia. It should be. with safety and all the design like that. But Angle Park's been around for 50 years. So some of the infrastructure has been there for 50 years. So it's incredible that back in the day, it was something that has been so well sustained. But obviously in today's racing climate, there are some things that need to be adjusted to cater for the safety and just upgrading. So interested to hear what that is all about there.
Dan, back in your peak, you used to hang around with the hoity-toity, and there was a time when you and your old mate John Dunn and used to hang out with Robbie Williams, and you're going to reminisce about that Robbie Williams era when we get John Dunn on this morning? The only thing is that only John Dunn was aware that it was Robbie Williams.
Yeah, it's quite a funny story, actually. Even when you tell people, I actually need to have John there to say that I'm not making it up, because if I was on my own, I don't think anyone would actually believe what happened. But I ended up having a night on at the casino, betting and drinking with an English guy that we were high-fiving and having a laugh with for what seemed 2 to 3 hours. And I had no idea who it was. So
this is the casino in Auckland, is it?
In Christchurch.
Christchurch, right.
And apparently he'd played a concert just after the races, because it was New Zealand Cup week, you know. So he'd played at the Westpac Centre, I think they call it, just outside. But I didn't know who it was. I still didn't know, even when someone said, oh, that's Robbie Williams, you know. And I said, who? You know, so it would have been, I think, 2001, around that time. But, yeah, I was a bit embarrassed by it. But I had a ball, so did he. He's probably talking to his friends right now, talking about the night he got on the turfs and had a few bets with the race caller from Australia.
With Dan Malecki, yeah.
Lauren, so JD remembers it well. He might be able to explain it better.
Well, and he's got other things to talk about as well. Lauren, you know who Robbie Williams is, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you find it unusual that a 52-year-old man who 20 years ago, when he was at the peak and Robbie Williams was the biggest rock star in the world, that he didn't know who he was?
Definitely, yeah.
Does it tell you that Dan's a weirdo who listens to classical music and stuff and not contemporary music?
Yes. Yep.
Would that be about right, Dan?
Sounds about right.
Thanks very much, Lauren, for that. I think it was right on the cusp of him having some really good songs, and sort of 12 months later I realised how big he got. But I think he was still, put it this way, he was playing concerts in Christchurch, so I think he was still on the rise.
Yeah, right.
Fair enough.
But you've got to admit, sometimes when you see people in real life, they do look a little bit different without their makeup on and their gear and all that than what they do up on stage. And sometimes you do have to look twice, and I'm sure people look at me and think, God, is that the girl that, you know, used to work on TV when they see me in my dog clothes and I haven't got makeup on and all the rest of it? So we can change a little bit.
It is quite an extreme, Simone, as you
it
say.
Is. Yeah.
There are people there at home and they're thinking, what are dog clothes? Are they made of fur or what are they?
I know, it's probably just wearing dirty old tracksuit pants and boots and a jumper that's got holes in it and all the rest of it.
We've seen it and we don't want to see it again, Simone.
No.
Hey, Juddy's coming on this morning, Dan.
Yeah, that's great. He's been terrific, and went through the sales. The Nutrien equine sales were conducted over last weekend very successfully, I might add as well, and a lot to do with the draft. Came from Ben Studd, really well supported by some of our biggest studs in Alabar. They had their first $100,000 yearling Alabar and Ben Studd. So we'll get a wrap up from Craig as to how they went. They had the sales topper as well, so I think he should have a big smile on his face, but we'll get it right from the person at hand to let us know how the wash-up was with both Ben Studd and the Nutrien sale from last week.
I rang him during the week just after, and I said, how was it? He goes, oh, man, it was the craziest thing, because logistically, Simone, 41 lots. I mean, that's a lot of horses to organise for a horse sale and to have it all run smoothly. So I'm interested in talking to Craig Judd, our mate, about the logistics of not just being the sales topper and probably the most successful vendor, but how the hell he did it. Anyway, that will be coming up on Cracking the Codes later on this morning, but now let's take our first break on Cracking the Codes.
Well, it brings back some memories. Where are you going with this, Simone and Matthew?
Well, the whole world recognises the artist Bayou, so we needed to get your partner in crime, Johnny Dunn, on to sort of verify this story of your oblivious encounter with the world's greatest rock star. So you better introduce him.
Yeah, John Dunn is the CEO of the Geelong Harness Racing Club, and we'll talk about the meeting there at Geelong tonight in just a moment. But JD, we were brothers in arms that night. We had no idea who the heck we were playing roulette and blackjack with and having a drink with, did we? But our friend, who was a bit starstruck, did, but he couldn't speak for 3 hours. It was a memorable night, even though we had no idea who we were dealing with at that time.
Said Dennis, a night you and I'll never forget. Normally it's Robbie Williams entertaining the people. I've got to say, for one Monday night at the casino in Christchurch, I think we entertained Robbie Williams.
Yeah, well, I think you're right.
It's possible. So, Dunny, we need some clarity here, because on face value, there's something weird about the fact that Dan wasn't aware who, and you weren't aware who the world's most famous rock star was at the time. So Dan's saying that his star hadn't risen all that high by that stage. Is that an excuse you're saying as well, that he wasn't quite Robbie Williams yet?
Combination of that and some green drink that I was drinking, Matty.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Snake Eyes.
The Christchurch special.
Yeah. But Dan's right. Our mutual friend that was with us, he was a mad Robbie Williams fan. He would have known Robbie Williams from day one when he emerged. And he was virtually, as Dan suggested, he was unable to speak. He was trying to talk and couldn't. He was absolutely starstruck. So he was sort of comatose while Dan and I were, as Dan said, were playing the tables. And occasionally we'd have a win and he would have a win. And we'd be high-fiving each other. If someone had said to you all the way down the track, you'll be playing roulette with Robbie Williams and high-fiving. And I've got to say, Dan, I don't know about you, when I tell people that story now, I get some funny looks.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Dunny, to this mystery Pom, you know, during this, you know, wild card game at the casino, did you ever say to this Pom, hey, Pommy, mate, do you have any idea who you're playing with here? This guy's called 15 Inter Dominions.
Well, and as you know, Matty, Dan is the king of Christchurch. So
I know, they fate him over there. In fact, he probably would have been equal billing with Robbie Williams in Christchurch on that weekend. So
no, Robbie would have been the undercard.
See, I wasn't going silly.
Yeah.
But it was probably nice thing that you didn't know who he was. It was probably just nice that you enjoyed the moment without being starstruck like.
Well, I think I know what I'm like sometimes. You know, when you get to that conversation where, oh, so what do you do for a living? And sometimes I try to avoid that. You're letting your hair down, you're having a bit of a drink, you're hoping no paparazzi around to see you in the state that you are and all that sort of stuff. So sometimes certain things are better left unsaid, and enjoyed the moment. I think exactly the same thing happened with him, JD, didn't it? And I think that's why we got along so well. I think if I'd said, hey, are you Robbie Williams, or what do you do for a living, it might have changed the whole night. So I think he enjoyed it.
I think you're right. I think you're right, Simone. It would have become obvious to him that both Dan and I had no idea and didn't care who he was. And I think that added to the night. And the hour and a half spent there, he was just like a normal, for whatever better term, human being. And I'm sure he just loved a bit of anonymity for an hour and a half, playing with a couple of blokes he'd never met, having a couple of drinks and winning on the roulette table. He looked like he was thoroughly enjoying himself.
I'll tell you a funny little story. We will get onto the real reason we're getting you on in a minute with the standalone Geelong winning, but there was a racing breakfast at the Park Hyatt Hotel about 15 years ago, right? And you had to catch a lift up about three floors to get to where it was. So we get in the lift and there's a few people in there and there's a man standing at the back and there's two women come in and turn around and there's a flyer in the lift promoting the fact that James Rain was doing an acoustic string of songs at this racing launch, and these two women they're facing the lift door and the man's behind them and I'm in the lift with them, and they read the flyer and they go, oh, James Rain, he's so yesterday's news. He's got that horrible squealy voice that no one can even understand. And, oh, God, you know, who'd go and see him? Then the lift opens for them to get out and he's right behind them. He goes, I am here, you know. Dead set true story. And I knew the whole time that he was there. And I'm thinking, oh, shut up, ladies, please. Don't say any more. And I could look around and he's just standing there with this really offended look on his face. And I've got a mate who's a mate of his, and he hasn't brought it up yet, but he's going to bring that story up. I'm sure he'll remember it too, don't worry. Why are we talking to you this morning, Dunny? What's going on down at Geelong tonight that's so special?
Matty, for the first time since 2008, we're actually hosting the Metropolitan Meeting of the Week. So with the upgrading of the Melton track there, at the present time, the meeting on Saturday night is here at Beckley Park. And it really gives us a chance to showcase the work that's been done here in the past 12 months. We've spent over $1 million on the complex, pretty well upgrading everything from a brand new float car park, upgrading the driver's room, stabling area. And the winning post end of the grandstand has always been pretty barren. In fact, it's been bench seats on concrete floor. So now it's the winning post bar and restaurant. We seat 120, 140 people behind the glass, and it really gives us a chance to showcase the place at a Metropolitan meeting, which is, as you said, is coming to our way on Saturday night.
I'm only 5 minutes from the track, and I thought, what a great meeting to come to, because you've got some great horses there, and in particular Tornado Valley, that I know you'll be hoping he wins and passes that $1 million mark. But it does look like a really good program, John. You must be rapt to have such a meeting heading your way.
No, for sure. We've got 9 races on the program. The first is early start, 5:34, but as you said, Simone, we're keeping everything crossed, fingers and toes crossed for Tornado Valley, of course. He needs to win to break the $1 million mark in prize money. He's drawn inside of the second race, Cleaver, the class horse in the race, and barring bad luck, I think he should win, and pretty sure Harness Racing Victoria have got some promotional ideas ready for when he wins. I think there'll be gifts handed out to trainer and driver Andy Gaff and Kate Gaff. There'll be some Tornado Valley hats distributed on the track. So we're prepared if he wins to make some sort of song and dance about it.
Where does he rank among the elite trotters, Victorian trotters of the last, not Australasian, because we know we've got Lyle Creek and all those David Mosses and all those monster trotters, but in the context of Victorian trotters, Dan and John, where would Tornado Valley rank in the last 25 years?
Oh, he's the best of the last few years, John.
Yeah, look, I've got to say, his record stands up. Look, there's been higher profile, more charismatic trotters, I suppose, Dan. We've seen them, Lyle Creek and the David Mosses of the world and that, but his record, he's a 9-time Group 1 winner. So, I mean, that's a record that puts him up with the trotting greats, I would say, in the modern era. 9 times, and he's not finished yet.
No, and he nearly was before he won the Great Southern Star this year. At the start of the week, you'll remember, guys, that he was closer to being retired than running in that Great Southern Star. Andy and Kate were looking just for a tiny little excuse not to run him, and they couldn't find it. And he comes out, breaks the track record in a heat, and then wins the final on the same night. So in some way, the biggest race that he has won, he did win an Inter-Dominion Trotters Championship, was well and truly at the end of his, towards the end of his career, when he was probably $1.10 to be sitting in a paddock, retired, rather than winning the Great Southern Star, which is quite phenomenal. And Andy's idea was to keep pressing on with him and to see if he can get the $1 million mark. So I know it's it was a target for Andy, which will be pretty special, guys.
You're right, Dan. In fact, it's quite staggering. I was talking to Andy about that time, and he was saying that, look, he's never been a flash track worker, but he really was not setting the place on fire at home. And as you said, Dan, the retirement was looming. And it was a last minute decision to put him in the Great Southern Star. Not only did he win, he won twice on one night. Winning the heat in the final. So. It was to come from near retirement to winning the Great Southern Star with the 2 wins in the night is quite staggering.
And to have that first meeting back at Geelong and have that marquee horse, at the time, I think a marquee horse deserves to be running around and getting centre stage race number 3. So I'm sure it'll be a huge night tonight. John, I know you'll be wrapped, and I feel confident in saying it might be the first of many Saturday night Metro class meetings for Geelong in the future. And congratulations on the job that you are doing at Geelong.
Thanks, Dan. As you said, we've got the place, as they say. We've built the place now. We just need the people to come in. Also, yeah, it'd be nice to get some more Friday and Saturday night race meetings down the track.
And if there's famous,
you build it, they will come.
And if there's famous musicians there of the contemporary era, then you blokes won't have any idea who the hell they are.
every chance of that.
Probably true.
Good on you, Duddy. Good luck tonight.
Thanks, Matty. Thanks, Simone. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, it'd be a great program tonight at Geelong. It was a tremendous Nutrien Equine sale, their inaugural sale in harness racing, and we've had a chat to one of the main players of that sale, and that's Ben Studd and Craig Judd, the proprietor of these two studs that make up a Ben Studd. And not only did they have 41 that went through the sales there, they also had the sales topper. And it was a very successful sale. We saw some big prices about some magnificent looking yearlings, and Ben Studd had a number of those. And Craig Judd joins us this morning to talk about the wrap up and to see how he fared throughout that inaugural Nutrien Equine sale. Good morning to you, Craig.
Good day, Dan. How are you, mate?
Yeah, look, we're thinking about you. We know how hard you were working in the lead up to that sale. Gee, you presented some magnificent horses there. Tell us about the wash up, and I mean, you got the sales topper. Who's going to go to New Zealand, by the way? And the likes of, you know, your Mark Purden, Gene Feast bought the horse, and they must be wrapped with what they got.
Yeah, he was a beautiful animal, Dan. He was 180,000 out of our Golden Goddess. She was a champion mare in her own right, won just short of 500,000. And, yeah, it was great to have Jean back in the Australian market buying, and Mark Purden, of course. I spoke to Mark last night, and the horse is about to fly out to New Zealand, and absolutely ecstatic with the horse, how he looks, and, you know, they're really looking forward to breaking him in.
Hey, when I spoke to you a day after the sale finished, I said, how was it? And you go, oh, my God, I am knackered. Tell us about 41, logistically, 41 yearlings. And I think the original draft was a bit higher, but came down to 41. Like, the process of getting those horses from your, I don't know whether it's the two different farms, one in Victoria and also the one in New South Wales, but tell us about the logistical exercise of what you pulled off at that sale.
Yeah, it was actually 49 we presented on the day. So, yeah, 49 we took through the ring. We originally had 51 or 2 catalogued. It was massive. So we prepared 20 of those in in New South Wales. We did 6 weeks preparation with them here, and then we did the other 30-odd in Victoria. And then I brought the New South Wales ones down. I just wanted to do my videos and pictures and everything so that they looked the same. And we're a bit stiff, and as you guys were aware, you guys were coming over to the yearling parade and on the Sunday, so I had them down there the Thursday before that, and we got 70 mils of rain on the night before, so we had to call that off, and we didn't get to do our normal sort of paddock videos, and so we just did lead videos and still shots. So we brought them all to Victoria, it was crazy. We had mum and dad and my brother-in-law's father, and it was pretty much all family and a handful of staff, and just an enormous job. It's sort of half to two-thirds of a day's work, exercising and brushing and looking after the yearlings.
And it's a very high-tech, classy-looking production these days, because I had a look at the video of Lot 61, which I think Jodie Quinlan bought, and smashing colt, by the way, dark brown near black colt, and the video quality, and I thought, gee, you've got to do this for all of them. How much time and effort and skill and even cost is required in that part of the package, the video packages?
Yeah, well, we used Wild Colts production, so that was the first time we used those guys, and they were just amazing, very patient, but I really knew their craft. I've been told that Inglis have actually spoken to them since, about just the angles they used and the videography that they used and how good it was. So we were guided by them a lot. But we had brother-in-law Mark, you walked them for most of the videos, and I think he clocked up over a couple of days, 38 kilometres, to give you a bit of an idea. Obviously, then we got to get still shots and the likes. So I think it took 40 to 50 minutes per horse. So it was an enormous job, and we wanted to make sure that the horses were led correctly, their posture, you know, and the way they behaved. We weren't willing to take shortcuts, so we just kept walking and walking until we got the right shots. And these guys, as I say, the Wild Colts production, Andrew Yeo and Selena, just were, you know, super patient, and they wanted what we wanted, which was, you know, a really good quality video.
Well, Craig, they certainly were. I've sat and looked at a few of them, but there was one horse that caught my eye, and I keep going back to him. Not that I'm going to, you know, buy him or anything or want a share, but lot number 138, who was a rock and roll dance horse out of a Save Me Christian mare, and went for $25,000. But when I've looked at some of the other horses that you've had on the videos, this horse really... he just stood out to me. He looked very thoroughbred-y in his body. When he moved, he you could see the definite standard bred traits. But something about lot 138, can you remember him amidst all the others?
Yeah, absolutely. He was one that was born and bred on the farm up here for Mick Harvey. The dancers can be a little bit plain at times. He was by rock and roll dance, and they can be a little bit plain, but he was a startling-looking horse and fantastic moving horse. The mother, Amy Christian, has left a one reasonable winners from three or four foals, but she's actually a sister to Fleur de Lille and Miss Galvinator, I think it was, that won. So those horses won over $1 million each. So I actually thought he might have brought a little bit more money.
Juddy, only a couple of weeks earlier at the same complex, the thoroughbreds went to, and some of the prices were million plus and, you know, averages of hundreds of thousands of dollars and so on. So the standardbreds are, they don't quite reach those prices, but they have been sort of raising eyebrows at the same time. Your expectations going in about what your lots might reach, and it's obviously you had the sales topper as well. Are the prices continuing to go up for the harness horses as they are with the gallops?
Yeah, most definitely. This is the first time that Nutrien have had a go at the sales for us. We obviously approached them a few years ago, not just us, but a consortium of people. And these guys have taken the sale average. Well, the competitors' sale, I think they averaged about 25,000. These guys managed to average just under 32,000. So it's heading in the right direction. I think they turned over $6.5 million. For my own clients, I think they averaged about 38,000. And then, you know, you have a look at Lauriston, I think Bloodstock, they averaged about 55,000. And Yabby Farms averaged 41,000. They turned over $1.2 million worth of stock. So these guys just took it to a whole new level, and I expect that to just continue on that path. I think a lot of people, you know, obviously didn't know Nutrien as a sales company for horses or for standardbreds, and now that they've experienced that, I think the sale will just keep, you know, on a trajectory.
And Craig, what about your clearance rate, Ben Stud? Often, if there's anything that, you know, didn't hit the mark, you've got your vendors or breeders within that might not have been satisfied with where the reserve was. Often they can end up going for a lease or a deal's done afterwards. By the looks of things, Simone's wanting to get into a harness horse. So what do you do with those, and where did you end up?
Yeah, well, we ended up with three out of the 49 are still passed in. So we had quite a few passed in on the day, but we've managed to be able to sell most of them since. I think there was an element of people sort of sitting back and a little bit cautious and not knowing, you know, the market with the new sales company and the likes. And then since then, Nutrien have worked really, really hard. I got a phone call off them on the Sunday night and then the Monday, and they were working the phones, so we've managed to get rid of all of them. So I've got one that I actually bought back myself, which I offered for... she was actually out of a sister to Lazarus, and her foals, she's had a few foals that have gone quite well for the sales. I put a 50,000 reserve on her, didn't meet the mark, get the money I wanted, so I reduced that reserve to 40,000, and still wasn't anyone interested, so I put her on socials and worked the phones a little bit myself, and then I thought, oh, well, if they don't want to pay it, I'll buy it myself because she was a beautiful filly. So I've got her. We've got one trotting colt left over. And I think there may be one other that we didn't sell. So we've actually, our clearance rate's been exceptional.
So you took 41 through and you've had a high
49,
level,
mate.
Sorry, yeah, 49. 49. You, yeah. And you've had a high level of success off the farm over the years. If you put 49 through, is there an expectation that four or five of them will be Group 1 winners? Is that kind of the level of expectation you might have or not?
I hope so, mate. I certainly hope so. Yeah, look, we had quality. There's no excuses. The horses have been given every chance. You know, all our better lots have gone to great trainers. Like you said, the top lot, the Golden Goddess, has gone to Mark Purden. So there's no excuses for the horses. And, yeah, our expectation is that out of that lot, we should have some really, really nice horses. I mean, we've had the likes of Bling It On and, you know, in recent times, Tough Tilly, Centenario, Philadelphia Man. I think one year that Dad bred eight horses, and of those, one was Soho Valencia and the other one was Philadelphia Man. So I guess we always aim as high as we can, and we're optimistic that these horses have been given every chance, so there should be a nice bunch of horses come out of this.
And, of course, with that extra couple of months, just the maturity and the size of some of those horses, they look much closer to being racehorses, didn't they? I think this year, through the COVID of last year, the extension of the breeding season, they were pretty impressive individuals, probably, you know, the most impressive yearlings that collectively I've seen, Craig.
Yeah, they were incredible. And I really like that too, Dan. The horses have been given an opportunity to grow out properly before they're being asked to do the exercise and the work that we require of them. And most of the trainers, I mean, really, you haven't had to use a lot of imagination. You can look at the horse and imagine it in the cart. And most of the buyers have sent the horses straight to the breakers. So they're big, strong individuals that are ready to now, you know, the next progression of their life.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, congratulations to you and to your team and to Ben Studd and putting in the, well, it's almost a legacy now, what you've created. The hard part is trying to maintain it and match it going forward, mate, but I'm sure you can, and it was worth it.
That's right, Dan. Everyone else has taken the level of their marketing, and everything that they did this year just went to a completely different level. So, yeah, it's pretty hard to compete now. We used to think we're a bit innovative and trying new things, but everyone was beating us to a jump, which is just fantastic for the industry and the sport going forward.
And we look forward to being at the Open Day next year. And if it's going to rain, maybe some Ben Studd overcoats or raincoats, and there'd be no excuse.
A bit of merchandise wouldn't go astray, Juddy, to be honest, in the mail.
Well, I'll send you down a Ben Studd hat, but it won't cover very much. But I'll send that down to you, boys.
Winter jackets, maybe? Might be a bit of an upgrade from the cap, perhaps?
Right, let's work on that.
Okay.
It'll be 40 degrees next year. Hey, listen, well done. Well done to you and the team, Craig. Look forward to catching up soon.
Wonderful, guys. Thank you very much.
Terrific talking to Craig Judd again and Ben Studd. They certainly produced some beautiful yearlings at the recent Nutrien sales. Heading into state now, we head to South Australia, where we're going to be chatting to Matt Corby, the CEO there of South Australian Racing, because Angle Park are undergoing a massive redevelopment, a brand new track, amongst some other minor things as well. So, Matt, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes.
That's a pleasure, Simone, and it's unusually quiet at Angle Park. We had a meeting yesterday in the grandstand, and work's already commenced, and so it's a bit of a ghost town, but it's stage one of a very exciting project for us.
Matt, for those of us who maybe bet too much on the greyhounds late at night and sort of wonder where all these tracks are, like Dapto and Albion Park and Angle Park, but we know where Adelaide is. Where, just put us at Angle Park. If we're looking at a Google Maps, where's Angle Park?
So just slightly to the north of Adelaide, and really you're probably talking, if you could picture, four suburbs out from the city. Most things are pretty accessible in Adelaide. It's not like Melbourne and Sydney where you have to push things out. So it's probably about an 8 kilometre drive from the middle of town.
So to the
north.
Sorry, Matt. For a 4-month redevelopment, that's quite ambitious, is it? Or you think you'll be able to hit that target with no problems at all? It looks like a massive redevelopment.
Oh, it's ambitious. I guess the fact is, when you're talking about headquarters, you've really got no choice. Two things. It's headquarters, so the rail issues that we were facing and the ageing problem with the infrastructure had to be addressed. So the first thing is this was inevitable and we had to do it at some point in time. And so given that, we want to get back to a return at racing at Angle Park as soon as possible. So we have created a really tight schedule. There's a whole lot of trades that need to be coordinated in that four-month period. But we've got it all mapped out, and with a little bit of luck with the weather and if we can keep things on track, we do believe it's something that we can deliver on.
Matt, was there ever a thought of a relocation or going to another venue, or was everyone just happy to embrace and update Angle Park and turn it into an ageing to a new facility?
Yeah, well, I guess with Angle Park, one of the first things is that we own the land, and that's really important, I think, in racing, that you can control the asset that you're working to. For example, Gawler is a leased premise, and so we've got we invested a bit over $2 million in facilities up there 5 years ago on a 21-year lease. Now, we'd be confident of getting that lease renewed in 2035, but you don't like being at the whim of other parties, and so Angle Park for us is headquarters. Our industry believe it's our spiritual headquarters, if you like. And so we were never in doubt that we were going to make sure that we stayed at Angle Park for the future. It's our core here in Adelaide. So now with all of this ageing infrastructure, we've had the rail in place for about 50 years and all the surrounding infrastructure, and it hasn't had the benefit of any of modern science of the last 20 years in terms of the underlays and about the track design and camber. And so it really was starting to get to the point where it was becoming a risk to us that it could just break down and we'd be forced to stop racing against our will. So at least this way we control the timing, and we'll address all of that and bring it back up to speed. And the one thing about the project is the track won't look much different at the end. There'll be a big video screen and some other things, and we'll be changing the lawn areas so that people can get closer to the track. But the track itself is a pretty subtle change. A lot of cambering and banking that's slightly different, but to the naked eye, it'll just look like there's a new rail and some new starts, obviously.
Yeah, with those starts, Matt, you've got the four starts. You're going from the 388 metres back to the 342, the 515 up to the 530, 600 back 5 metres to 595, and the 731 almost the same at 730. So the biggest difference there, apart from the short, the 388 to the 342, is going up 15 metres for the sprinters. Now, Adelaide or Angle Park's always been regarded a leader's track, hasn't it? And a weaker type of dog could almost pick up races week in, week out, whereas the 530 metres, it's going to require something a little bit stronger, you would think?
That's right, Simone. And it's funny, people listening to this who weren't as familiar with the sport might sit there and say, well, it's only another 15 metres over 500. But it does matter. You know that. And it's it will probably require a greyhound to be a slightly stronger proposition at the end of a race to be successful. But I think that's good. There's also a separate school of thought which says with longer transitions, that meaning the turns take longer to get to a point in the straight where they become genuinely straight, that also suits a leader in theory. So I guess you've got two things offsetting each other. Bigger transitions might suit leaders. That slightly longer distance might suit the swoopers. So maybe it all cancels out to an even balance.
And a new clean slate of track records, because all the previous track records will be redundant.
Yes, I'm sure everyone will be eager to get in race one on the first night we reopen, because they're guaranteed a track record.
Actually, that's a good selling point, isn't it? The first greyhound, even if it's the quickest of the slow, then you might be able to get it on socials and sell it for an increased sum, because for a little while it's the fastest dog at Angle Park.
Yeah, well, Murray Bridge we only opened a few years ago, and I know that people were keen to record the first win up there. I think it was Bosco Stamenkovic from memory, and it was 3 or 4 years back. So it does sit in the memory tank, and I couldn't possibly tell you who won the second race. so it is a little piece of posterity, you're right. The Brett Lee record, we're talking in the background about some sort of statue or acknowledgement for Brett Lee, because that track record at Angle Park, I think most people would agree, was the absolutely unassailable track record for any metropolitan track around the country. And no other dog has really got close to beating it, including the types of Betty's Angel and the like, who despite putting their best foot forward, were still four or five lengths off. So so we'll try and make sure we've got something in place to acknowledge that fantastic little slice of history.
Well, let's take a listen to it now, the 2001 Adelaide Cup.
Racing in the Cup. Brett Lee began magnificently, and he's going to go to the front, the favourite from Classic Capri, who drove through to second. Oh, Big Bother was likely excuse. Into the back, it's Brett Lee. Going to second now was Classic Capri. They're five in front of Renzo Bale, no intent. Then came Dutchie's Angel, 10 away to Brandon Bale. Sue Ellen Bale, forget about likely excuse. But Brett Lee, he's on the bunny. He led six over Classic Capri. Then Renzo Bale into the straight. It's all Brett Lee. We might be looking at a champion here, ladies and gentlemen. Brett Lee won it in 28.87. Classic Capri second, Renzo Bale third, Dutchie's Angel fourth. Then no intent, Brandon Bale.
Well, he certainly is a champion, Matt, and he'll go down in the history books with the old Angle Park, of course. And look, it's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you this morning and really looking forward to what transpires there at Angle Park. And, of course, you're racing at Gawler and Murray Bridge in the interim, which will give some other trainers a chance not to travel so far, perhaps. But looking forward to seeing the redevelopment.
Good on you, Simone. And I feel sorry just hearing that call for Classic Capri.
Yes.
If I'm right, I think Classic Capri has run the second fastest time in history at Angle Park. So, but just happened to run into Brett Lee that night. So,
and she won a Melbourne Cup too, so she was no slouch.
No slouch, agreed. Thanks very much, Simone. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Matt. It's been great having you on this morning, and a little bit of interstate flavour there this morning, guys, from Matt Corby, the CEO at South Australian Racing.
Are you as intrigued as I am whenever you see even towns that have racetracks? If you have a bet, Dan, and you go, I don't even really know where this joint is, like Bow Desert or, you know, some of these city greyhound tracks. You think, I wonder if I drive through that city, if I'll drive straight past Angle Park or not.
I'd tell you a funny story if we've got half a second. My good mate, Hong Kong Hutchie, Clint Hutchison of Racing.com, obviously lived in Perth and it was in Hong Kong for a lot of time, came back and relocated to Melbourne just a few years ago. And he was at home and saw that Richmond Dogs were on. So he thought, oh, I might pop out to Richmond. It's just, it's in the city. So he jumped in a cab and asked the bloke to take him to Richmond Dogs. And that is a true story.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that, this old guy who I used to sort of, we used to look after, he was in an old person's home, we used to take him around. They used to race at Richmond in Melbourne, but it was Whippet Racing.
And he used to,
he used to paint them different colours. He was a complete crook, the old bloke.
Yep.
He was an old pastry
old
chef,
Channel,
he was a complete crook.
Channel 9 building, that they used to run on that ground. They had a harness track there, turn of the century, of the 20th century. So it's got a bit of history about it. So he was only about 60 or 70 years out.
Yeah, and about 900 kilometres as well. So, so Lauren, before we came on, Lauren said, oh, hey, can I, every week I look forward to the magic of this coming in on a Saturday morning. And so how was the magic out of 10 this morning, Lauren? What was your absolute high, and was some of the panellists even a little bit disappointing this morning?
Oh, look, I reckon it was better than last week.
Oh, hang on. She declared last week a lemon.
Wow.
Oh, tell Max Presnell you didn't like him.
I think she's becoming very comfortable with RSN, isn't she?
Being a little, very critical as well, yeah.
A critical of who's sitting in the studio with her, perhaps.
No, that's probably
Dan
right.
Dan and I are sort of remote, so we're probably safe.
No, you're in the gun as well, by the sound of things. Hey, good on you guys. I'm looking forward to getting out to Caulfield for the big Vobis Day. Daniel and then looking at the big Sydney races with all the champions going around there. What's on for you today, Simone?
I'll head to Geelong tonight. I think that would be a great meeting to go to. We've got horsey things on this weekend with Darcy competing tomorrow and getting a pony ready today as well. But I think we'll head out to see Tornado Valley.
You might even run into the man himself, our very own Robbie Williams. Dan Malek.
Dan.
Or at least John Dunn.
Or at least
share the same story.
Share the story again. Good on you guys. Have a great day. And I'll see you at 10, Dan, for the 10 till 12. Yep. And we'll catch up next week.
Look forward to it. Have a great day, everyone.